Yeah, what I mean by non when I say non-classicality is that I'm actually witnessing a failure of the classical causal theory into explaining some behavior which is observed in a given causal structure. The most famous example of this, of course, is the Bell scenario. Which is simply described like this. And we have a source of correlations here. And this scenario is actually understood as the obtained via the conjunction of three hypotheses, right? The no signaling hypothesis. Plus local realism and something that only came up later, the measurement independence assumption. Now, these ideas they are pretty basic and they kind of frame what we would expect from a physical theory, how we would expect a physical theory to behave 40 years ago, 50 years ago, actually 60 years ago. Yeah, we just got older, right? And the thing is, if you replace that source with a quantum state, we get behaviors that cannot be explained by causal theory. This is what I don't know. And when you look at this, then you may start to ask yourself, okay, so this causal structure doesn't explain it. But can I actually drop some of the hypothesis in order to make it in order to give it the capability of explaining some this kind of behavior. And this start to be doing to being done a long time ago, and more specifically, we start to asking, okay, what's the how much do I have to relax those hypotheses in order to be able to explain some a given behavior? I mean, if I'm going to consider this possibility here, which is a relaxation of the no signaling hypothesis, how strong does this communication need to be, right? So this was this,
very true.
yeah.
So that's a relaxation of no signal.
Exactly.
But can't I put an error while still making independent of that? Like, wouldn't carrying the arrow be more of a violation of local realism than a violation of assuming?
You
Like, in the sense that,
okay.
if like lambda provides some noise that gets added to x to give me b, I could still have an arrow from x to b, but no signaling from that.
Oh, okay, yeah, you could. But then you would be referring to a fine tuning model, right? So we
but
usually
that
don't.
fine-tuning is not on your list of assumptions.
Oh, okay, true. True. So it's not on my list of assumptions, but I'm going to assume. So let me.
Okay.
And. Classical causal theory without fine tuning. Double N here? Just one, right? These double letters in English, they make me crazy. Okay, and this kind of question start to be doing in this sense, specifically in the sense how little relaxation, how is the least amount of relaxation I need to be able to explain a behavior? To my best knowledge, in 2003, so there were some models presented before that. For instance, there was in 88 the Brands model, which actually he provides a way to an experiment in which one of these assumptions is not guaranteed, but he can violate Binaquat. But this, I'm talking about you actually try to reduce to the minimum the violation of the relaxation. Okay, so this starts in 2003 with, I believe, Toner and Bacon, and independently with Pironio. And we have this scenario here. Again, the usual Bell scenario. And they ask, what if I allow this? And how weak can this be in order for me to reproduce the statistics observed in a Bell experiment when I replace the classical source with the quantum source? So let me just give credit to Dan here, Toner and Bacon and Pironio.
Toner and Bacon, imagine, was not a failure of no signaling, but a failure of no fine tuning. Their model reproduces the no signaling results, but it does it with fine tuning.
Okay, I see. Yeah, I may have misplaced those concepts. I see.
Was very consistent in terms of what no signaling meant to different groups. Nowadays, we understand that no signaling is a purely statistical concept, but my impression is that back in 2003, some people were using no signaling as a causal thing.
But just relative to our current usage, if I look at the Toner-Bacon model, it preserves the operational independence of B and X, but it does certainly have a causal dependence of B on X.
I see.
And that's because it's what we would call today a fine.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, the really interesting thing for us is a question that started to come to the literature in 2011, I guess, 2010, by Michael Hall. And what he did is, okay. So here I'm looking at a question. Here I'm looking at a question related with the idea of no signaling. But what if I try to look for a relaxation that is actually related to measurement independence? As I said before, there's this early paper which says, okay, you can actually create a model which does not comply with this hypothesis, and it will reproduce any quantum result. So Michael Hall considered this kind of communication scenario, in which the common source was able to choose not just A and B, but actually X and Y. And this is very interesting because this topic and came up several times after this work in literature. It is, for instance, it was one of the motivations, one of the loopholes we are trying to get rid of in the cosmic Bell test. I think that it gets very clear when you look at the sequence of Bell tests that were performed, right? In 2014, you have this paper from Zeilinger, which you he would say, okay, should we have something like this? It gotta has been triggered 600 years ago, and then in 2018 we have this other one who says, okay, if we have something like this, it has to be triggered some million years ago, a few million years ago. So this idea keep coming up in literature. It's tightly related with the concept of super determinism, and it's very, very relevant for topics for the area of fundamental topics, foundations of quantum mechanics. And this treatment here was improved somehow. A better approach to this problem was introduced in 2016 by Chaves et al. In which, instead of analyzing specific this scenario, he focused on this one, which is a bit different, but has a nice feature that it can be casted as a linear program. So of course, when I'm trying to make this dependence here as weak as possible, I need to quantify this dependence, right, somehow. In this paper from Chaves et al., he does the following. He defines the quantity m of x, y, given lambda, and lambda, as the sum of x, y, lambda. And I'm, throughout the seminar, I'm going to use capital cases, capital letters for random variables, and lowercase letters for its realizations. Okay. And the thing is, this can be casted as a linear program. Now, of course, when how did this analysis here, as well as Stoner, they would have to quantify this relation as well. And they used an entropic quantity, the mutual information between x, y, and lambda. And they do this analysis, how specifically does this analysis analytically? Okay, so it's very it's a very restricted analysis. It holds for the CHSH scenario, okay, in which x has two all visible variables here. They have only two possible realizations. The cardinality is two. And then, and how can I turn this into a linear program? So I'm trying to see the minimal amount of relaxation I need to explain a given behavior, an observed behavior. So I'm going to call this quantity here measurement dependence, which is a relaxation of the measurement independence, and I will try to minimize it, okay? So actually, I'm trying to in the end, I'm trying to minimize over all possible realizations of this, of chi, the amount measurement dependence such that subject to having some projector that acts on some vector, and this vector Q is essentially a vector of all the distributions of these variables. So Q will be P of chi equals 0, P of chi equals 1, and so on. Recovering the observed distribution of the visible nodes. And of course, and how can I turn this into a linear program? Well, I can, the first thing that I can do is to show that this quantity here can actually be written as the L1 norm of some matrix M acting on Q. Okay? This is actually quite easily done. Just a few operations here. And then I will set up as some slack variables. And I will say that MQ is always less or equal than T. And minus MQ is always less or equal and or equal than T. And now I'm not optimizing just over P of Q, which is P of chi, which is essentially Q. I'm optimizing at both Q and T.
George.
And oh, yeah.
Just when you said the absolute value of M Q can easily reproduce M X Y colon lambda, I can see for P X Y lambda term that that's just some operation on Q, because Q is the distribution of the, I guess that's a capital
chi. Capital chi.
Yeah. But how do I get the minus the other term? How do I think of P X Y times P lambda as an operation on chi? Because
oh, this is given. This
oh,
is observed.
That's given. And then what about P of lambda then? Oh, so P of lambda is just whatever the response function of lambda is.
Exactly. Exactly.
I see. So plug in your operational data about PXY there.
Exactly.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
If you want, I can open it. Make it step by step.
No, it's I understand. No, I'm just missing that one piece of information.
Okay. So this can be actually expressed as this. And by doing this, if I minimize over the sum of t, the sum of the entries of t, which is clearly positive because of these constraints, then I get the minimum value of this quantity here. So what I'm going to do is minimize over these two quantities this, in which one vector is a vector, the entry, all the entries of which are 1. Okay? And yeah, by solving this, we got to some interesting results. They get some numerical evidence. So numerical evidence that given the CGLMP inequalities, it holds that the minimum of this quantity over, you know, P of chi of this quantity here which violates the CGLMP by a given amount is exactly given by the max the maximum over among between 0 and ID minus 2 over 4.
ID is the... Is the
yeah, it's the quantity of the CGRMP object.
Is
D is the number of inputs. So in the CGRMP, you have this possibility of several inputs. Is it several inputs or several outputs? Now I got... so this D will be varying either the number of inputs, I mean the cardinality of those two variables or those two variables. I don't quite recall now which one are. But they found numerical evidence, and by this I mean they solved the problem a few times for different cardinalities, and they found this relation, that this relation would hold for all the problems they solved. And
they varied over the cardinality of chi, or?
No, the cardinality of y and b. Because the cardinality of chi is actually bounded. You actually can set up a bound on it. By
with lambda, you can there's some maximum cardinality lambda you can
do. Exactly.
Okay, got it.
So you can actually recover some results of previous work using the Pinsker inequality. I think that's how it writes. And which is going to say that this quantity here over this is actually always greater or equal than the minimum of over P of chi of M X Y lambda squared. And that's a nice result we get, which recovers the some things in literature. And okay, we can analyze now this problem.
The first statement, numerical evidence, is that under a uniform distribution over x and y, or is that regardless of the distribution over x and y?
So this result here, they consider a uniform distribution over x, y. In principle, you didn't have to be tied to that condition. But again, you have to be able to attribute some distribution here. You have to assume some distribution here.
If you're going to run a linear program.
If you want to work with a linear program. And this is tricky because the more you get away from the uniform distribution, the less interesting this measurement gets, because you are actually trying to minimize the relations between this guy and these guys. But as you see here, this guy can correlate these two guys. So yeah, if you get away from a uniform distribution, then those guys start to be able to be correlated, and then you have something not that good going on.
I would think that it's the correlation between lambda and x and y that's the measurement dependence. Like just correlating x and y without correlating anything with lambda won't help you violate a Bell inequality.
Yeah.
But biasing x.
Yeah, biasing would.
So if I bias x, that limits how well it can be correlated with lambda. So that kind of limits how much measurement dependence. And if I bias both x and y, like if x and y are both really close to point distributions, then that means like it can't have much measurement dependence because there's the marginal on x and y is very close to point distribution, so they're almost uncorrelated with lambda.
Yeah, but then you are no longer looking at the if you do that by fixing violation, wouldn't you be somehow improving the results by other means than measurement dependence? making it less, making this quantity here, the result of this program, less faithful to the problem?
I don't know. I don't have strong intuition. Let me ask it this way. In the limit that x and y become point distributed, like they're both definitely zero, well now the common cause can't explain any bundling polygonization. There's no opportunity for any measurement dependence. So is there some threshold? Like if I go from x and y being, you know, the distribution of x and y being uniform down to it being a point distribution, there should be a transition at some point to you can't explain given inequality violation, but does that transition happen only when they become point distributed, or does it happen at some finite degree of correlation?
So, do you have something?
Well, I think your premise of in the limit, you can't use measurement dependence to the explanation. In the limit, you don't have any Bell inequality violation, because Bell inequality requires that you, you know, sum the terms.
Okay, good point. So then, let me rephrase my question. If I have just a little bit of support on all the values I need to check out,
arbitrarily little.
Yeah, like arbitrarily small. Do I still have enough measurement dependence to explain it, or no?
Yeah, so I can tell you, I must say, I've never investigated this specifically.
Right.
My intuition is that you would be able to do this.
Okay.
Because what I can see is that, okay, that might give actually some intuition. Pick up, set up a quantum state, choose a nice setup to violate maximally the Bell inequality you are working with, put it here, and now just change the distributions of x, y. Okay? Everything is the same, but you are choosing x, y differently, according to different distributions. This quantity here, the result of this linear program here, we'll get more and more worse. We'll get more worse as you get far from the uniform distribution. So I would say that somehow, and the uniform distribution assures me that those two are separable. So I would say that somehow, this is my intuition talking, as I allow for correlations between those two guys, I allow for some mechanism that is able to create violations and at the same time evading this construction here. It's not a definitive answer to your question, but I think it provides some intuition about it. Okay.
This is off the cuff, is that, you know, to get violation of inequality, you want to have A and B correlated in three of the four situations that's given x and y, right? So what we'll do is we'll just have lambda be some coin flip, and A is the same coin for Alice and Bob. Indeed, they just both report the value of lambda, and you get correlation. And that works, except for the case when x and y are both 1. But what you can say is that chi is sort of influencing x and y, it's constructing the distribution over x and y, then it basically doesn't affect lambda at all unless it says that x and y should be 1, because it controls them. And in those instances where x and y take the value 1, it overrides the value of lambda that b sees. And so then you achieve, you know, c plus h being 4. But if that situation where x and y are both 1, only occurs 1% of the time, then the actual amount of measurement dependence formally is quite low, because generally speaking, chi is doing a lot of work to manipulate x and y. It's suppressing that event, but it's only influencing the sort of natural state of lambda one in every 100 runs. So it's not much measurement dependence, and yet it gives you like a PR box.
I agree with all that except your conclusion. It seems to me like that logic gets to the point that yes, maybe lambda, x, and y very infrequently take on the value correlated. But when I condition on x and y both being 1, you know, lambda is fixed. So the sort of correlations between lambda and x and y or what we're interested in,
yes,
not the relative frequencies of x and y taking certain values. So it seems to be the amount of measurement dependence will be just as strong.
No, because the way measurement dependence is defined is as this average of p of x, y, lambda minus p of x, y, p of lambda. And on average, those are going to be independent, except on the case where x, right, the probability that x and y.
I don't think that's an averaging. It's just a measure of the distance between the factorizing distribution and the other one. I think it's independent of, except, certainly if we were talking about the mutual information between x, y, and lambda, like called it, and clearly that would not be impacted by the relative frequencies of epsilon. We agree on that, right? That's how we were quantifying measurement dependence.
Right? No, so, I would not agree to that.
So mutual information between pair x, y, and lambda can be equal even if certain values of x and y are very improbable, right? It doesn't care about the marginal.
It can, but the point is, if we could also keep that mutual information quite low, if we only need to sort of have a causal relationship between x, y, and lambda infrequently. And we can get away with an infrequent causal relationship, so that the mutual information x, y, and lambda is quite small, if we sort of only move away from if we only move away from factorization in a small subspace over the distribution of x and y. So I disagree.
I think I see what you're saying. Okay.
I mean, I'm not saying this with confidence, but like we can come back to that.
Why don't you continue? Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we now know a tool that allows us to we actually know many tools allow us to evaluate this quantity, and we can now consider it in more complex scenarios, right? We can consider, for instance, the Fritz scenario. And well, what's this scenario? It's in this 2016 paper, Fritz proposed this structure here, presents this structure here, and in order to say that this structure is interesting in the sense that it has it's not saturated and it has there are quantum behaviors that violate the bounds set by this structure, which cannot be attained by which violates the bounds set by classical causal theory in this structure here. Yes, sure. Thank you. And then he says, okay, I can consider this structure here as in the following way. So let me just so I don't get lost in my notation. And he was trying to say, as I said, he was trying to show that there are quantum behaviors here that cannot be explained by classical causal theory, and say, hey, look at this. C and lambda they are inseparable, right? And that's easily seen because every path connecting C to lambda has a collider. You're not conditioning on anything, so they are inseparable by the empty set. And they say, okay, if X and C, X, Y, and C are perfectly correlated, then they cannot be correlated with lambda. So you recover your Bell scenario here, because you don't have these arrows, and these guys are perfectly correlated. You can have your test. And then his argument is, if I make these sources here in a way that they perfectly correlate X, Y, and C, and this source here is a quantum state, a maximally entangled quantum state, and I'm performing the measurements defined in the Bell experiment, then I can assure you there is a quantum distribution which is violating this which cannot be explained by classical causal theory in this structure here. But because his argument were only aiming at, you know, providing a proof of principle, I guess that's the reason why that's the best I can do is guess. They are not concerned with any kind of robustness. So what if they assume perfect correlations? And that's not very nice for some experiments, or in general, right? In particular, if you are working with experiments that must be performed in a very short time window, that can be really problematic. And then it comes the question, can we make this robust? Can we make this robust? And well, there is this paper we published in 2021, which is just to give credit. In which we use the entropic approach. We are working in the channel cone, and we combine some analytic results, linear quantified elimination, and I guess inflation to analyze this structure here. And we get some nice bounds on the mutual information of X, Y, lambda as a function of, I think it's this way, of the entropic vector, right? Using exactly the same quantifier than Michael Hall used before. And now this is very nice because then we have the perspective of it's a vector of entropy in the channel cone. So age of A, age of B, age of C, age of AB, age of AC, age of BC.
And they relate to
ABC,
X, and Y as well? Or X and Y?
Just... Yeah, yeah. I think that they... I think you use all the variables here, and then you just make a quantified elimination to take off the non-visible ones, right?
Oh, I see. So you're going through the...
It's linear, yeah. Okay, it's linear because the channel cone is convex. The cone is convex. Then we have the We have the perspective of some practical application because we actually enlarged the set of distributions, of non-classical distributions we were witnessing. And we also have some nice insights. About foundations of quantum mechanics. Because you see, whenever you make a perfect correlated thing, and I'm considering somehow that this is mediated by quantum state, I'm assuming this quantum state is probably pure. And, well, do they exist in the universe? Could you have but now we are not talking about something perfectly correlated anymore. And this is very nice. And then, but then you could ask, okay, so when Michael Hall did his analysis, he used this figure of merit. And it was a nice analysis, but it got improved, and our results were included in an analysis using this quantity here instead of this one. So can we...
What do you mean exactly by improved? Are you saying that you detect the fact that you could not explain a given inequality violation with measure of dependence more easily...
This way, than this way, yeah. More specifically, using this inequality here, you recover these results here.
So the numerical evidence is a stronger inequality than the one Pinsker came up. That one that you get from Pinsker, which is what Paul.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
You can use this result here to get a result here that is stronger than the result obtained here. Actually, I think it's the same. It's equally strong. But so it's at least as good as, but then the results here are not constrained to the CHSH scenario. You can make this analysis with wherever you want, which is nice. And then a natural question is, can we use that quantity, the same quantity here, to make this analysis, to analyze this scenario here. And it turns out that we find a nice way of doing this. So we are going to be working with this quantity here, and we are going to consider two marginal scenarios. We are going to marginalize both A and B, obtaining this scenario here. And we are going to marginalize this scenario. We are going to marginalize C, leading to this scenario here.
Can I just like pause to make sure that I'm understanding sort of the motivation for using this new quant thing? So if we're just dealing with entropy counts, it's quite easy. We can get this particular quantity, x, y, given lambda. We can say, okay, we know what our entropies are. We can upper bound it. We can lower bound it from the partial information about the entropy count, which corresponds to the observed data.
Okay.
And my recollection is that if we just take all of the data that's coming in about x, y, a, b, c, forget the distribution, just look at the entropies of a, b, x, y, c, we can't obtain a contradiction. We have no way of sort of witnessing non-classicality with that. Even if we sort of say, oh, but we're going to use this intermediate quantity. Because in principle, we can just say, like, forget an intermediate quantity. We can just say, like, we can ignore the intermediate quantities. We can just say, like, there exist these lambdas, gamma 1 and gamma 2. They're classical. We set up the entropy cone. We look at the projection of the entropy cone. Is it the case that our entropic data is inconsistent with being a marginal of that entropy cone, with, you know, these restrictions stolen in the program? We can check it, and we cannot find a contradiction.
Exactly.
The reason why, if we use this sort of intermediary, it buys us something, is that we're not throwing away the distribution and just working in trees. At least for the lower bounds,
yeah,
we go through the distribution. So we say we have observational data. We use that observational data to compute a lower bound on this neutral information. And we do that in such a way that it actually really uses the distribution itself. It doesn't just fall back to the entropies. In fact, it looks like CHCH violation. And we know that, you know, you can have CHCH violations and CHCH non-violating distributions, which are the exact same entropies. So, like, clearly, the distribution really matters here. But when we exploit the distribution, we get some non-trivial lower bound. And then, even though the upper bound just comes from entropies, it's enough to obtain.
Exactly.
So one thought would be, well, maybe we could still go with this quantity, but get the upper bound without falling back to entropies at the first step. Just like in we had a lower bound where it was an entropic quantity, but we used the properties of the distribution to obtain a lower bound. So too, we could have an entropic quantity, but we do some sort of clever use of the distribution to obtain an upper bound, which is a better upper bound than would come from just using the entropies themselves.
But I see.
Do that. And now you're saying, what if we just use this intermediate quantity? So the nice thing is we already have a lower bound on this intermediate quantity coming from properties of distribution. But what we were missing prior, I think, to your original work was even the idea of how we would obtain an upper bound. So if it's an entropic quantity, at least we know how to obtain an upper bound from entropies. We don't have to be clever, we just do the Shannon conversion. But if we start using this intermediate quantity, how would we even obtain lower bound from the distribution? And that's kind of why we didn't do that in the first paper.
Yeah, so you are asking essentially the motivation to using this quantity. But at the same time, you acknowledge that this quantity here actually yields the lower bound of this quantity here. This is essentially what we are using. The lower bound that we use in our analytical result in this paper is it's the Pinsker inequality, which is known to be a bad inequality in the sense that it holds. I mean, there's nothing bad in an equation, but it's really non-tight. You understand me? So I have this quantity here, which yields the results we use here via a non-tight inequality.
Right.
And I'm proposing to do both things, do the thing you were asking for, which is find a better upper bound. And at the same time, by doing this, I am eliminating this quantity here, which I have no reason anymore to carry out. I was carrying this out so I could work in the Shannon cone, which is convex. But I no longer need, if I find a way of working directly with this efficiently, and the linear program is efficient, Then I can get rid of all these extra complicated steps.
It's not just trying to exploit the properties of diffusion as opposed to properties of entropy. The motivation is that the Pinsker inequality is not tight, and so if we can avoid an analysis that relies on it, it provides more opportunity to sort of have this failure between upper and lower bounds.
Exactly. Exactly. So, considering these two scenarios, what we have is that it actually can be, they actually can be relaxed into these two scenarios here. Also, let me use some different color, otherwise it's going to look like I'm putting an extra arrow, which I'm not. This is not. So let me draw something that is not a causal effect arrow. It's just an associative arrow, the symbol of associative arrow. So I can simplify this structures to this. And relax these structures to these ones. And here, oh, sorry. And considering these two scenarios, I can actually cast the problem of evaluating an upper bound and a lower bound to this quantity as an LP.
So when you said relax, you meant everything in the upper diagram can also be explained with choices of parameters in the bottom of the diagram, but not necessarily vice versa.
Yeah, more specifically, in order to be a relaxation, there should be an extra variable here, which would represent gamma 1, gamma 2. But you can actually show that for if you are working with a maximization, and this is the scenario in which I'm going to look for an upper bound, then you can forget about this one.
I could have just observed gamma 1, gamma 2 into the definition of lambda in that bottom diagram.
Yeah, it's not that simple because
lambda is something that you want it to be the same lambda.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
So, but we can show that when you are working with the upper bound, you can actually forget about this. So, yeah. When I do this extra step, and he, this is clearly maximizing this quantity here is clearly an LP because it's a convex scenario, and it's a linear function as I showed. And here we are just using the same tools that Chaves used in 2016, Chaves et al. So we can do this, and we get we get what I'm calling a better result than we had in this paper here. And in order to illustrate how better this result is, I'm actually going to use this example that was experimentally implemented. So consider the following experiment. Following example. Assume that you have a C variable here, which produces an outcome C. Okay? And how it does produce this outcome? Well, it receives a a part of a quantum state phi 1 and phi 2 and performs some measurement on this composite system and obtains our outcome. Now, the other part of this state is sent to the lab. Okay? And in this lab, the same happens here. I'm going to erase this because I'm going to need some more space in the middle and in the bottom. Yeah. And they're going to send the other part of this state here and here. Plus, I have two other sources. I have a Pascal source, which is going to send a message yb. Sorry, this y is lowercase y. K. And I'm going to send a message xa. Okay, just in order to avoid confusion, I'm going to put a tilde there. And this source is such that P of A, B given X, Y equals to 1 over 2 delta of A plus B tilde tilde x tilde y. Right? Plus, I'm going to have a quantum, and I'm going to have some distribution over k, which is independent of those values. Plus, I'm going to have a quantum source. And this quantum source will produce the without space here, let me just put sq equals to 1, 2, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. So it's a maximally entangled state, right? And it sends part of it for here, part of it for here. And these labs are going to work in the following way. If k equals to 0. Let me just see if I'm using k equals to 0. Yeah. 0? Yeah. If k equals to 0, then I have x equal to x tilde, a equals to a tilde, x and a being the outcome produced by in the lab. Okay? But if k equals to 1, then I'm going to be performing over these quantum shared quantum state measurements, which are chosen according to measurement performed on this part of the state. And those measurements would be such that I maximally violate the quantum the CHSH inequality. Okay? The same will happen this side. If k equals 0, then y equals y tilde, and b equals b tilde. And if k equals to 1, I go ahead and pull the Bell experiment. Okay?
Which is to say you completely ignore x tilde and a tilde.
I completely ignore. Exactly.
X is determined from psi 1, and a is determined from the result of performing said measurement.
Exactly. If I do this experiment, now, it's always interesting to take a moment and look at this and think, okay, what if I was doing this in a Bell scenario, only a Bell scenario? So I would always have some kind of non-classically witnessed, right? Because I'm between the CHSH values I'm working with are between 2 square root of 2 and 4. So despite this source here is an artificial PR box, I'm actually, if I ignore measurement that measurement dependence maybe taking place, I'm going to say, oh, I have a PR box here. But here, in this context, this is clearly a source of classical correlations. There's nothing about it that can be labeled as non-classical. But the thing is, if we working with this scenario, we make the same analysis, this analysis here, using this figure of merit here, and we plot mxy given lambda as a function. Now, notice that as the distributions are well defined, I have a linear map between P of k and the CHSH value. So I'm going to put here CHSH instead of k because the value width I'm going to obtain that is interesting here is obtaining the CHSH. Yeah. So if I plot the upper bound, which is this quantity here, it must start from zero, right? Because when P of k equals to zero, then I'm completely ignoring this x tilde and this y tilde. And x and y are completely defined by C.
That's when k equals 1, not 0.
Oh, sorry. Oh, okay. So the other way around. In a way that when my probability of k equals to 1 is 0. Okay, so I'm starting at the lower point of the, exactly. I'm starting at the lower point of the Bell violation.
K equals 1. That's the probability of k equals 1 is 1.
Let me just fix this because
it's the same scale, but it's not solid.
It's the same thing, but the probability of k equals to zero, I'm at the Bell point, which is the lowest value of the CHSH I have in the value. And in this case, my measurement dependence, in order to violate, it doesn't start from zero because I already have some violation. It goes like this, where here it would be 4, and here would be, I believe, half. But if I look at the upper bound in this quantity,
okay, sorry, to go back. Saying that the lower bound, which is if you're trying to find an entirely classical explanation,
yeah,
so you're not availing yourself of positive quantum things, then even just with the 2 root 2, there's going to have to be some measurement dependence in any classical explanation. So
exactly.
The lower bound is non-zero, even at 2 root 2. Okay.
Exactly. And if I plot the upper bound, let me just figure this line out. So if when I have CHSH equals to zero, I have perfect correlation between the X and the Y with C, and hence they cannot depend on this on the source here, on the lambda. So I start from zero, and it got to this maximum value, which is 1.5. Oh, use that here, right? 1.5. 0.5. And here's where this region here is where the magic happens. Because in this region, which ends up in 3.029, I have the lower bound larger than the upper bound, which is an inconsistency. And this reveals to me non-classicality. Yeah, I think it's right. And this is very nice. Now,
out of curiosity, like when you draw these curves, are they actually straight lines?
Straight lines.
Both
of them.
Upper and lower bound are linear.
Linear, they have to be. If you pick up any of those problems and you go to the duo, you have that the constraints, they need to be linear,
cool.
Right? So the result of both scenarios must be linear curves.
Okay. But if you did the exact same thing with a different intermediary quantity, namely the old intermediary quantity, then presumably you'd still have like an intersection point, but the intersection point would be earlier and maybe not.
Yeah. And why this? Okay, this is cool by itself, but it's cooler because we actually have an experimental result from the people from Rome, which let me just But here that between 2 square root of 2 and between 3.029, we have non-classicality. And we have one experimental result. In which we can witness non-classicality, consider this experiment using this technique.
So I don't remember what they said about the relative weight of Bell and Bompierre Box. Would you remember for the one that gets you between strings, but the relative weight?
I remember the violation. It's 2.63. The value of CHSH. Right. It's 2.63.
It's mostly Bell, but 10% or something.
I think that is the best Bell they produced without any correlation with the classical source.
Oh, I see. So it's a case where they're targeting all Bell.
Yeah. But then...
Remind me, what's the decimal expression of 2 root 2? That's
2.7 something.
2.8 to... something.
Okay. And you said 2.6. So
because this analysis here, it's actually restricted to this. But right. When I analyze the experimental point, I don't look at the violation of the CHSH. I mean, that's a waste. You have an experiment that yield to you 16 estimatives of probabilities, and you would not reduce those 16 constraints to just one constraint. You go directly and work with P of X, A, B, Y, and C.
Okay, but couldn't you also say, well, it's possible to expand the analysis you just did to let CHSH be even smaller than 2 root 2?
Yeah,
still,
sure,
you
sure.
Can still witness non-
sure, you could you case. Could make it, you could put a
yeah,
a parameter here and...
Yeah. hexagonalizes. Extended this guy to the left.
For the left. And it's still, and it has to be, I mean, we can actually find the quantities just by extending these lines. Because you can see that the problem is still has, stable. Exactly. This line goes like this.
And your experimental point is really actually on the left of the vertical axis.
Yeah. It is on the left, but I think it's interesting for us to actually be able to find something on the right of the yeah. of here. Yeah. Because then we are actually mixing PR yeah. box.
Well, I asked because I had the impression that our last report from the people in Rome, they didn't have any points on the way. It sounds like you're confirming that. We still don't have anything above 2.2.
Yeah, no. We don't, but yeah. One thing that I noticed is that the points they send in the points that send, X and Y are not uniformly distributed. And as I said earlier, this is an issue for us. We need X and Y to be uniform as possible.
But you're expecting that for an experiment done correctly, there will be points where for a seed to stage violation greater than 2.2, we see a violation, even though the current analysis of the actual experimental data only yields a violation for a seed stage value, which is large, but not quite over that threshold. So it's a situation where the green line is the upper bound.
Well, I would say that in principle, for a perfect experiment, of course, we would have violations. It's what the optimizations are.
It's so. I think that this is. A misleading graph because what we do need to have
this is upper.
Any analysis is we need to have that we both have some stage violation, but we also need to have some essentially probability that C is predicting X and Y. That from the value of C, that is the correct guess for X and Y. Right. Beyond just like a 1/4. And there's some sort of trade-off, which is that on one extreme, C can perfectly predict X and Y, but then you don't have much C to C.
So at least my understanding, George, telling me this right, is that what's incorporated in this calculation is the assumption that C predicts X and Y perfectly in the case where you've got the zero and not at all in the case where you have k equal 1. So you sort of assume that as an ideal, and that establishes the upper bound. But you could go and look at the nuances of the experiment where that's not perfect, and maybe the upper bound rises above zero a little bit, but it'll be close to this. Like this is the ideal version of the upper bound. Yeah?
Yeah. So yeah, we got this nice result. And we have, once we have all these new tools, we can consider new scenarios, you know, when we are very interested on is to consider the bilocal scenario. The board is crazy. Okay, so you have to write it quickly because.
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying, but I'm saying it'd be nice for like a theory side of things if we could have like maybe a 3D plot right. Where we'd have like these upper and lower bounds of measurements and CHCH on one scale. But that would really sort of the only thing that would really impact would be the lower bound, right? The upper bound would sort of not inherently have anything to do with CHCH. And then the other axis would be this probability that C correctly guesses X and Y. And that would affect the upper bound, not really the lower bound. And then an experimental team can just forget about their data. They just sort of see like, okay, what's this probability? Where am I here? Where am I here? Am I in some region of this plot where the upper bound and the lower bound are such that I have a contradiction?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. So we have this nice. We are very interested in this scenario, the local scenario, which is essentially X A B Z C. And we have two different classical sources. Two different sources. Here. And we can actually analyze measurement dependence in this scenario. Because I found this way of testing it as a linear quadratic constrained problem, which is tractable nowadays. And we could actually make an analysis like this one of this problem. There would be no inconvenience about it. And once we know the how does measurement dependence behaves in this scenario, which I think it's already interesting by itself, because you know it could be the case that measurement dependence here would be, it's very likely actually, the measurement dependence here will represent a different resource than measurement dependence in the Bell scenario. But we don't have to stop here. We can actually pick up this and go to, and using a similar strategy than Fritz used, I believe Fritz is here. Using a different similar strategy than what Fritz used, we can think about something like this. We have a square scenario, A, B, C, D. We have sources here which correlate these guys. And then we can just split those nodes, those two nodes here, into XA. And ZC. And if you look at this, you can see that this part of the analysis is already performed. Because it has exactly the same structure that the one here, the one we used here, with the exception that now I have an extra node here in the middle. But in principle, it's very likely that we can make this analysis exactly in the same way we did before. And one problem that we may have here is the size of the problem, right? Because the solvers that use that accept this kind of problem, they are a bit more slow. And now I'm not saying that this will solve the problem of scalability of solving these problems, but it could be the case that for solving this, if the problem got too big, because we need these slack variables, we could work with the infinite norm instead with the L1 norm. And then it would be a way of quantifying this measurement dependence. I'm not sure if it's as good as the measurement dependence as using the L1 norm, but it would have all the properties we are looking for. It's zero if and only if this got here zero, and so on. And we actually, instead of needing to double the size of the problem, we just need to add one variable to and make the same analysis, right? So this is one of the possibilities. We could also try to consider scenarios with more inputs, more parts, and the same basic Bell structure, which would amount to two layers network, one which is connected by lambda one, and the other connected by these intermediate nodes. So yeah, we have some possibilities of expanding these results into interesting directions.